It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today, casual Friday. As always, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Then, later, to recommend movies for me and talk about his new book, Tasteful Nudes, Dave Hill. Also on the program today, all sorts of stories. A programming note, Monday will be Memorial Day. We will have no program for you. No program. Great time for you to catch up on some of the shows you may have missed from this past week, including a great interview we did yesterday with two whistleblowers, Thomas Drake and Jesselyn Raddick, one whistleblower from the NSA and his lawyer, who was a whistleblower at the Department of Justice. That is a must listen to. And also, if you hadn't listened to that Alec Lures interview that we did with the 16-year-old kid who is suing the U.S. government for over climate change, worth listening to just to make you feel better that there is some hope in the future. When you hear a 16-year-old kid like this, very inspiring. On Memorial Day, of course. A good time for you to recall the fact that we are still fighting a war in Afghanistan. And no one is clear why. But hopefully that will be ending soon. And reflect upon the past 10 years, 11 years now, that we've been fighting 2 years, two wars for most of that time. And ask yourself why. And remember that we've lost over 5,000 U.S. military personnel during that time. Scores of thousands have been injured. Suicide rates now nearly at an all-time high for veterans. And also think about the civilian casualties that we have caused around the world with our tax dollars. So that is on Memorial Day, and of course, have a safe weekend as well. Every day I get up and pray to John, and he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring, yes, audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. They support the program. You go there, you are supporting the program because they're giving away a free Audible book download. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get a free audio book. You can pick up Charles Ferguson's book, Predator Nation, corporate criminals, political corruption, and the hijacking of America. We spoke to him earlier this week on the Majority Report. Pick up a free Audible download at audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Do it now. Take the skinheads falling, take them falling. Take the skinheads falling, take them falling. Take the skinheads falling, take them falling. So let's get to today's program. And before we do bring Cliff Schechter on, we first should listen to the Cliff Schechter theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, new media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Oh, Cliff, it seems like months since we've spoken.
It really does, Sammy. Quite a week it's been.
It has
so
been
much going on.
It really has been quite a week. And before we get to, because I want to talk about Cory Booker, because the 6 days of Cory Bookerness that has taken place, I think are very instructive.
The Bookerosity.
The Bookerosity. And also there's this, you know, we have not anticipated a lot of movement on what's going to happen in terms of attacks on Social Security, attacks on Medicare, some notion of a grand bargain, the default end of the Bush tax cuts on January 1st, 2013. We haven't talked much about the lame duck session because it's 6 months away, I guess, at this point. But news this week is going to impact that quite a bit, and I want to talk about that as well. But before we do, we spoke, I think, last week about Tucker Carlson. And because Alex Perine has already now started doing his, like, hackathon pieces at salon.com. Wonderful pieces. You should check this out if you haven't already, folks. I know you have, Cliff.
I mean, and Tucker Swanson McNear Carlson, the 14th. I don't know what number he is, but that actually is his name.
Yes, there is.
Swanson Fast Food, Swanson Frozen Food, my man.
I know. And it's always
fun. It's a tough upbringing sometimes.
Well, what's really sad is just sort of like how pathetic, how desperate he is to prove that he can be a success, I guess, in some measure, and the lengths that he will go to promote his website, The Daily Caller. And, you know, this is relevant also because we have another piece in Salon.com, actually, by a guy named Michael Fumento, and you may be more familiar with him than I am on some level, but for no particular reason, and he is talking about the extreme on the right. But I had to bring this up with you because, of course, for those who don't know, readers of the Daily Caller have the opportunity to win a handgun. They're giving out, I guess it's a handgun a week until Election Day. Maybe they got a deal on handguns as opposed to tote bags or swag. You know, we give out DVDs on this program, but a handgun, you know, a DVD, you watch it once. A handgun, you could shoot people forever.
Exactly. Think of all the many people you can shoot. And being that the National Rifle Association just came out with a new, I'm not even kidding about this, insurance policy. I tweeted it out today, which if you stand your ground and you defend yourself, if you're willing to buy this insurance policy, they will cover all your legal fees for standing your ground. So,
wait a second. Are you serious?
Oh, I'm dead serious. And dead is the right word. I tweeted it out today. I'll retweet it after we're done. But, you know, just in case you feel the need to shoot another unarmed black teenager carrying Skittles, you now have can rest at peace, have the sort of peace of mind that the NRA will cover your legal bills when they come after you. And the family sues you in civil court, at the very least, if you're not arrested and tried. So that's good to know.
That is so
stunning. Seriously.
I mean, it's so stunning. And frankly, you know, I hope you know, I hope there's some tort lawyers out there saying, great, now we got some deep pockets to go after. I mean, I would love to see the NRA get slapped with a huge. I mean, you know, that's just it's just beyond belief. Don't worry about stand your ground, folks, because we got your back. I mean, with money.
That's part of the sickness of this. Then the Daily Caller, the firearms manufacturer's name is Jim Pontillo, who is the one who they're getting these guns from. And I would bet, obviously, he's closely connected to the NRA. I'll explain all that to you in a second. But this gentleman, if I can call him that, I probably shouldn't give him that kind of credit for being a human. But he responded to President Obama by saying he will never be president of the United States. That job requires he represents all Americans, not just angry black ones. He has called for potential revolution in this country, armed against liberals, armed resistance to democratic government, integral to the American DNA. I can't imagine how much – this is a quote from him. I can't imagine how much more insult the American people are willing to endure under the enterprises of ambition by our politicians. But I do know gun ownership and an understanding of the American founder's vision will have a positive effect, and we can subdue overzealous and prejudicial government officials, blah, blah. I mean, whatever. I keep going on forever. The point is the guy is one of these nuts who believes in all the sort of Timothy McVeigh like fantasies of attacking our government, and is obviously racist. And this is beyond the fact that it's terrible enough that the Daily Caller thinks that it's an interesting marketing gimmick to hand out handguns for anybody that will read their stupid and pathetic site. In addition to that, they are raising this gentleman up.
And there's something particularly nauseating about the idea. I mean, look, you know, I guess if the Daily Caller said we're going to give out a gun a week for a year, but to do it in the run up to the election, there's just something particularly nauseating about that. I mean, the whole concept is ridiculous, but to do it in the run up to the election, there's another subtext there that I can't quite get my arms around, but I guess maybe I am aware of it. But you know,
no, there's no doubt there is. There's implications there, and they have the Second Amendment engraved, or the Bill of Rights, I guess, on the side of the gun. Even though they have no idea what the Second Amendment means from any historical perspective, or actually reading words like well-regulated militia. But I won't get into all that again on this show. Here's what's funny, ironic, I guess you can call it that. Chris Cox, who's a top lobbyist of the NRA and one of their chief bullshitters who just kind of makes things up, wrote a piece. This is back last September for the Daily Caller, saying how you know, basically arguing in favor of concealed carry reciprocity, which would mean that New York, for example, would have to respect concealed carry laws of Alaska, which, or you know, Utah, which essentially you can be drunk, blind, have a history of domestic violence. And I'm not making any of this up, by the way. You don't need any training with a gun or whatever to get a concealed carry permit, because states have very different standards, and New York has among the toughest standards to get one. And they're trying to pass this through, even though they claim they love states' rights, but they only love states' rights when it's useful, like states' rights. They want their view. So I responded, and I responded at the Daily Caller, and wrote a piece just ripping Chris Cox to shreds in December. And the irony of it – or I'm sorry, in September. And I think the irony of it is I think I may have helped out the Daily Caller and the NRA, because – I know this from talking to people behind the scenes, that they didn't like the idea that on the pages of the Daily Caller they were made to look stupid. So suddenly in last December there was this agreement with the NRA, and again I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, I just find this all kind of interesting, agreement with the NRA to have a guns and gear page, so the NRA would sponsor them and pump money to the Daily Caller to do this. And this is an extension of that. And so I think in a way I may have contributed to this, although it tells you that the NRA is scared about the press they're getting and the fact that if people are allowed to actually air their opinions and write in response to what they write, it will show people how insane and full of crap they are, so that they need to buy everybody off. And I think that's what they went and did, because nobody will let me write another piece of the Daily Caller responding to the NRA.
Well, so I'll tell you, Cliff, Sam, if you're responsible for this, then I think really the manly thing for you to do would be to underwrite the giving out of bulletproof vests on a weekly basis from the election via the majority report, we will give out to a listener a bulletproof vest a week to counter the Daily Caller's handguns that are going out. But, of course, you're going to have to underwrite that.
It's a little difficult for me right now financially, but I may look into a little bit of underwriting if it may be one or two. Perhaps.
Or what about like those Wonder Woman arm bracelets? You know, those old Wonder Woman arm bracelets that can deflect bullets. And, you know, people will have to rely on their own skills to deflect.
Or even better, like the Wonder Woman invisible airplane.
Yeah, well, let's not get carried away.
Just get on that, and no one will see you. But they're coming after you with a gun. If you, let's say, you happen to be eating Skittles, and somebody got a gun from the Daily Caller, from a gun manufacturer tied to the NRA, who thinks Obama only represents angry black people, then you can climb onto your trusty Wonder Woman plane and disappear.
Yeah, the shipping and handling on a jet like that would be just that would break us. Here, so I don't know if we can offer.
Where's Jamie Dimon when I need him? You know?
Indeed, but yeah, this is. I just wanted to bring this up because I knew I knew obviously this would be something that would get you riled, and it's just stunning. I mean, you bring up a good point about this NRA sponsoring the Daily Caller, because I challenge anybody to look at any right wing site, any right wing radio show that is not heavily underwritten by the Heritage Foundation, the NRA, I mean,
the Chamber of Commerce,
Breitbart Awards. Before Breitbart died back in August of last year, he got $10 million for his site from unnamed investors. You know, I can understand that private investors don't always want their names out there. But what was stunning to me is that he never even announced
Joe
it on
Ricketts?
He never announced it on his blog. He never said anything. At that time, for months, Breitbart.com was fully funded only by Google ads. I mean, so this is not a business investment. You got a site that's been up for 6 years and all they have is Google ads on their front page. I'm sorry. This is not a business investment. This is an underwriting.
No.
And this, I know this does not happen with left-wing sites. It simply does not happen.
You and I specifically know that because we happen to have been formally or currently involved with certain liberal projects. So I don't know, the Majority Report, We Act Radio. And yes, we've raised some money from some Democratic funders. But if I were to tell you what percent of 10 million that was, which I can't honestly tell you and come out and say exactly, but let me tell you that it would be a really small percent.
And to what extent is the CAP, for instance, Center for American Progress, how much ad buys do they have on WEAC Radio? I know the answer to that. It's zero. I mean, but if you listen to, 20 minutes of Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck or Michael Savage or Mark Levin, it's all Hillsdale College, which is the Heritage Foundation, it's the Heritage Foundation or it's Americans for Prosperity. I mean, on and on and on and on. Even
so they have an ecosystem on the right. I mean, there's just no doubt about it that this stuff was well planned out, and I mean, I'm not saying it's all to a T, but you know, I always point to, and we've had many discussions about this on the show. I always point to the year when everything changed, being 1973.
Right. This is the Powell memo. We talk about this.
Memo. The Heritage Foundation was founded in 73. ALEC was founded in 73. Paul Weyrich was at the.
Well, all of that emanated out of the Powell memo, yep. Which was commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce.
Of course, then the takeover by the far right of the NRA happened, I think it was 77, I'm sitting here in Cincinnati right now, the Cincinnati Revolt at their meeting here where the older guys were kicked out who actually had supported some gun control measures and really just cared about hunting and sportsmen and not about the gun manufacturing industry. I mean, everything changed in that decade, and I think it's disturbing. You know, do you know the writer? Do you ever read stuff by Robert Perry?
Occasionally.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and I don't want to get deep into – I know this wasn't the point of the show, but I'll tell you, if you study history and you see kind of the media manipulation that we did as a country in certain other countries, you know, that when we were going to have coups or trying to get rid of leftist governments, you can't help but see the parallels of what's been done here. And when you know how many of some of the former CIA guys were involved with the National Review and the American Spectator, which is fact, not – I'm not saying anything that's not fact here. It's a little spooky because I think they brought some of these guys learned some things out there in the world. Yeah, exactly. They learned some things out there and they brought it back to this country. And I think they have used what they learned in psyops and manipulation and, you know, and that's the reason for a lot of the reason the polarization that we've experienced with. I mean, again, you know, and this helps us take us to the Fermento piece. I mean, you can't just disagree at this point. You know, they have to sort of dehumanize. You know, the other side reminds me of Rwandan radio calling the Tutsis cockroaches.
Right.
You know, Fermento in his piece points out how on Michelle Malkin's site, in three different articles, she's referring to people on the left as monkeys or dogs. Or I mean, she's dehumanizing people is what she's doing, which makes it a lot easier when you get your Tucker Carlson gun to shoot them.
Indeed.
You know.
Indeed. All right. I want to move on to these other stories because in some ways, you know, I don't know. It's hard to know which is more relevant. But the right seems to be unchanging and, you know, at least consistent enough so that we know what they're up to. But a fascinating thing happened on Sunday, and we've talked about it on this program, so I don't want to go over it too much, at least at the beginning of the week. But Cory Booker's on Meet the Press last week. He talks about the attacks on Bain by the Obama campaign as basically being equivalent to the attacks on Obama for Reverend Wright by the Romney campaign, or at least those on the right who were hoping to fund it. And much of the commentary centered around a pushback on this notion of false equivalency. But I think this story was far more about a corporatist Democrat accidentally exposing himself. And then we saw him sort of back off it, but not really. Then we saw guys like Ed Rendell come out and talk about how private equity is so great. And by the end of the week, Cory Booker is on Twitter saying that medical marijuana should be legalized in New Jersey and that the war on drugs is ridiculous as some way of redeeming himself. And
the gay marriage thing.
And of course, the gay marriage thing, you know, hyping his socially progressive bona fides. Now, my feeling is that by the time that Cory Booker runs for governor of New Jersey, and by the time that he is trying to position himself for the presidency or the vice presidential spot in 8 years or wherever it is, that gay marriage is going to be about marriage equality is going to be about 70% approval.
And exist in at least, I would say, 20 states.
Yes, and we're going to be pretty close to that in terms of legalizing marijuana. I think we're already at 56%. So these are not controversial positions for a Democratic mayor of Newark to take 8 years before he's going to go on the national scene.
Astute positions to take.
Indeed.
Right now.
Indeed.
Among a growing segment of an electorate, as opposed to signing up your death warrant, almost quite literally, with a dying segment of the electorate, which is what the far right's doing right now. It's actually, if you're just looking at it from a political standpoint, it's a very smart place to put yourself.
Very smart place to put yourself. This is, you know, this is the equivalent of President Obama saying, "I'm against the war." Back in 2002. I mean, I don't know that was his calculation per se, but it certainly, at least in terms of a lesson for other politicians, it's a great lesson, you know, because then it gives you a chance to sort of finagle as you move forward. But the bottom line is, and now I think we're seeing this in this latest missive by Nancy Pelosi. The bottom line is that there is the money in politics, Wall Street money, just money period in politics is just such a corrosive force on the Democratic Party. And, you know, we know that come January 1st, all the Bush tax cuts are going to expire, all of them for everyone. We're going to go back to the Clinton rates. Unless...
Which were terrible.
Yes. We all know how horrible things were economically during the Clinton years.
Right.
Unless, that's going to happen if the Democrats do nothing. And so we have this battle now, and the Obama administration has said we need to go back to the Bush tax rates for anybody making over $250,000. because I guess the theory is, as opposed to everybody, the theory is that, A, from a political standpoint, they want to make it sound like there's a middle class tax cut. There's also an argument, economically speaking, that those tax cuts for people under making under $250,000 are the most stimulative at a time where we still have economic troubles and you don't want to impose any austerity via the tax via taxes. And now we have,
I have to come out and say I do agree with that, by the way.
I mean, I think there's an argument. I would like to see those sunset, though. I mean, if you're going to extend them, you know, make sure that they're make sure it's not a permanent extension. Make
right,
sure that it sunsets.
Fine. I just think right now during this time, I think it, and to me, it's not even just I guess partially there's the economic argument, but I think it's also just the personal argument, which is I think so many people at the bottom of the economic ladder have suffered because of this economy and because of a lack of regulation of banks and what they've gone through with their mortgages, that it seems like, you know, I'd rather would get them the spending they need. I would rather get them the regulation they need. But if I suppose if I can get them anything, they, you know what I mean? I'm just looking to get them anything I can possibly get them.
Well, yes.
Kind of
I mean,
I down on it.
The best case scenario is, frankly, tax everyone and begin to spend more. And we'll talk
yes,
about how the Obama administration is sort of bragging about their spending record because they have bought this frame that they shouldn't be spending in a time of recession. But Nancy Pelosi comes out. Boehner, about a week or two ago, says he wants to have a vote on this before the lame duck session on extending these Bush tax cuts. And Nancy Pelosi sort of preempts this by sending a letter to him saying, I demand that a vote on this now. And we want to extend the tax cuts, but for those people making $1 million or over. Now, this is a big this is moving the needle quite a bit, isn't it?
Oh, sure it is. I mean, you know, I think there was a time I don't remember when 5 years ago. I remember once I went on Fox News and we were talking about raising taxes. Yes, I actually did go on Fox News sometimes in the past, so you can laugh at me for that. And I went on Neil Cavuto's show, and I was arguing with good old Neil, and he, you know, we're talking about taxes going up, and back then the magic number was 150,000.
Right.
And he instructed me that 150,000 really wasn't a lot of money, which, you know, I won't even answer that. I will leave that out there for anyone to interpret. But and I'm sure for Neil Cavuto it isn't actually a lot of money. But that's the problem with this stuff is I you know, I think we need to update the way we look at things and how expensive things are. Sure, I think frankly our tax rates should be updated to reflect how our everything has changed, which is there obviously is a huge difference even between at this point what the top 1% is making versus what the top 0.1%. And so the Clinton era rates, if you were to ask me, aren't really nearly high enough on that top end, which is I think there should be an extra tax bracket, quite frankly, for people making over, you know, we could talk about it. Maybe it's 5 million. I don't know what it is, because there's so many now of these plutocrats that fall into that to tax them at a lower rate, I frankly think they should be taxed at a much higher rate.
No, I agree with that as well. I mean, I think we could add another marginal tax rate there. But and frankly, I would love to see the capital gains tax go back up to Bush levels, you know, back to 28%.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you should tax capital certainly no less than you tax work.
But people should understand that when you say we're going to extend these taxes for everybody below 100,000 or for everything that is made. The thing with marginal tax rates that many people don't understand is that when you say we're going to raise taxes if you're making over $1 million a year, that only applies to money made above and beyond $1 million.
That's right.
In other words,
and that is important. The millionaires will still get tax cuts on all of their money below $1 million.
If you make $1 million, you will still not be taxed at the rates you were taxed under Clinton for those dollars between $250,000 and $1 million. And by eliminating that money from being subject to tax,
right?
I'm sorry?
The entire thing up to the $1 million, right?
I mean, well, yes.
If you're going to say that we're that up to $1 million, we're going to keep the Bush tax rates, then really it's not just between 250, it's the entire thing.
Indeed. But the difference between $250,000 and $1 million would mean about 40% of the revenue you would lose. So in other words, the difference between $250,000 putting reinstituting those tax cuts at $250,000 as opposed to $1 million, 40% of the revenue. This is according to Citizens for Tax Justice.
Right.
40% of the revenue is lost. About half of the benefits of this higher threshold accrue to millionaires.
That's right.
So,
and that's why you can't do it. And that's why I agree exactly. It's sort of like the lines slowly get moved to the point where, you know, it's kind of the point I was making, which is the number was 150,000, you know, however many years ago.
Right.
It got moved to, and again, we do need to update with inflation. I understand all that, and I believe that. But at the same time, it almost seems like we're just picking numbers out of a hat. And in the end, and that's why I'm trying to say I'm not an economist. What all I want to do is, when I said that I would support it up to 250,000, is I'd like to get, you know, it bothers me, of course, that people who make $1 million will get that money back too in the first 250 because they don't need it. But I guess I'm trying to do whatever I can to help people at the bottom.
Well, I mean, there's an economic argument. There's an economic argument about that raising taxes in the context of a recession is not a good idea. It becomes
people on the bottom who are buying stuff. Not
right.
People
it becomes
who are not, right.
It becomes a stronger argument when you're talking about lower income earners, and
right.
You know, to include
that's the earned income tax credit argument, which is you know you put money back into people's pockets and. You know, but that's the problem, and I agree with you 100%, is once you're moving that line up, then a lion's share of that income starts going to people who do make a lot more money.
All right, so tell me, what's your sense of what's going on here? Because just this past week, sort of, and I think it's coincidental, because I don't think you organize a coalition this big, within a couple of days, or you certainly don't.
I think I can actually tell you exactly what's going on, Sam.
Can you really?
Americans
for Tax Fairness.
I've been told the truth by – okay, go ahead. Let me let you go ahead.
Let me just set the table. You tell me what's going on. Americans for Tax Fairness is a coalition of over 50 groups, including the AFL, AFSCME, SEIU, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Move On, the National Council of La Raza. I mean, a whole group of people basically pushing for raising the returning to those Clinton era rates for any dollar earned over $250,000, and basically saying that represents the top 2% of income earners in this country. And they came out with a strong statement, and they're pushing this. The Obama administration is saying still $250,000 is our cutoff. We've been saying that since 2007. But Nancy Pelosi comes in and says $1 million. We don't know where Harry Reid is in this because he hasn't been quite clear. You tell me what's going on.
Well, okay. And so let me tell you what I've been told is going on by people, by some insiders. Mm. And we'll see. You know, again, I can only tell you that it makes complete sense. And I've been told by people who apparently have had these conversations with some people pretty high up, which is that the official Democratic Party position in this election, particularly of legislative candidates, I think it'll be of Obama too, if it's not already, is to run on Simpson-Bowles, and to have that be the framework. So essentially, it's to tie the Paul Ryan budget around the Republican Party's neck and say they are of the Paul Ryan budget, and we are of the moderate, sensible Simpson-Bowles budget.
And so this is a massive game of chicken. In other words, the Democratic Party is running on the idea of essentially a grand bargain. Increase the taxes, cut Social Security and Medicare, and the idea is it's a game of chicken. From their perspective, we know the Republicans are never going to buy into any increase in taxes, so they will look like the unreasonable ones, and we will look like the reasonable ones, and that's what will happen. Give me your assessment of that strategy in terms of what it means, not electorally, but coming into the lame duck session. What does that mean that they have essentially pushed the margins of this debate? From where you know where Simpson-Bowles was, Nancy Pelosi was crapping on Simpson-Bowles a couple of years ago.
We had this conversation last week. I think it was last week. I've talked to you enough times, Sam. I think we talked for Ring of Fire, too. So I don't remember if it was on your show or it was on Ring of Fire, but we had this conversation, which is obviously I think it's a terrible strategy. I think, again, it's people trying to seem reasonable and moderate. I think it's what is also known as the minority party strategy. It's kind of like what the Republicans did in the mid part of the last century, which is they always try to seem reasonable. I happen to like those Republicans a lot better because I'm on the left. But the point being that it's when you stand up forcefully for what you believe in, and you know it also helps when that what you believe in is supported by like 80% of the public, like not touching Social Security. I don't see the upside to this. Really, short term, I don't know if there's definitively a problem because I think the Republicans are too crazy to jump on board this. They're actually the protection against this, which we've talked about before. But longer term, as we know, you know, it's kind of like what Rachel Maddow wrote about in her book Drift about what happened militarily. Really, that's not just a military thing. That's culture, how culture works in general. You know, the old frog boiling in the pot metaphor.
Right.
Things don't tend to change in a huge way. Here and there, they do in shock doctrine type ways when there's a terrorist attack or whatever. But more what it is, and, you know, which we've talked about this when it comes to civil liberties and the Obama administration adopting some of the Bush administration stuff so that it's become bipartisan. This is what happens again. It's the same thing with Social Security, which is in Medicare. There's a point where you say, absolutely, we will not touch the benefits that go to people that they've earned and they've worked for. But then when you cross that line and you're willing to cut those, then the next guy 4 years later is willing to go a little further. Or that next congressman who wants to make a name for himself and break away from the Democratic Party and show his independence goes a little further. And by the time you're done, suddenly that thing that you thought was sacred is no longer sacred. You know, and that's happened on all sorts of issues because, you know, I mean, again, people like to quote that famous letter that Dwight Eisenhower wrote to his brother, which was that any party that would, you know, it was only a couple crazy Texas oil guys, hint, hint, who wanted to cut Social Security and unemployment insurance, that any party that touched that would disappear from the world. But look where we are now.
Right.
You know, I mean, look where we've gotten. So now it's mainstream to talk about cutting Social Security.
And it's mainstream
to reject unemployment benefits and say, if you don't give us what we want, we're not going to give you those. That just shows how far we've come in a negative direction on economic issues.
And we see the Obama administration brag about the fact that they are the smallest government spender since Eisenhower. And
see, and that's another example of that slow, let's call it drift, you know, which is can you imagine Harry Truman standing up and saying that or LBJ standing up and saying, of course not.
Certainly not in the context of a recession. I mean, this is something they should be embarrassed about. This is something they should be railing against. They should be talking about we you know, because they have cut 600,000 – they have presided over government cutting 600,000 jobs on a federal or a state or a county or a municipal level, and that is dragging this economy down, or it's at least keeping it from recovery.
That's exactly right. I mean, during these times, obviously, is a whole other level of insanity. I mean, it's like, well, it didn't work in Greece. It didn't work. Well, of course it didn't work because it didn't work during the Great Depression. I mean, it's not like we don't have abundant evidence over more even beyond the Great Depression back to when Grover Cleveland tried it in the 1890s with a balanced budget Democrat. We know this stuff doesn't work. It's been tried again and again, and it has been tried internationally. It's been tried in our country. Hell, it's been tried in local economies where state governments are forced to balance their budget, and they fire all sorts of people, and that doesn't – what do you think that does? That offsets a lot of the stimulus. Now, I mean, we know this stuff. So again, this is not like we're learning anything new from what's happening in Greece. We're being reminded of what we already knew, but people have bought different results. You know, and so we're doing different things. And again, it's this slow drift. I mean, Clinton said the era of big government's over, but during Bill Clinton's time, he was still willing to raise taxes, you know, on people. He was still willing to pass the Family Medical Leave Act, which again was a government mandated program. You know, different than when we get to President Obama, we've drifted a little further, and now we're only willing to do it by market mechanisms. You know, yes, there's some government regulation, like, you know, for example, healthcare, where people you have to let people on, even if they've got pre-existing conditions. But we're doing it mostly through a market way, and we've moved a little further towards that. Now we're doing healthcare the same way that the Heritage Foundation wanted to do it in the 1980s, and Nixon wanted to do it in the 1960s. So we've moved to that position. We're arguably the healthcare bill that we just passed a few years ago is slightly to the right of where Nixon was on healthcare, and right around where the Heritage Foundation was 20 years ago, you know, or 15 years ago, whatever. But that keeps drifting, and now it's the same with Social Security. And so it's that way when it comes to government spending. You know, you brag about cutting government spending as if that's a good thing, because we've let the other side control the debate and say that all government spending is terrible, except for defense spending, which is awesome.
Right.
That's amazing and awesome. And so people can claim that they've cut spending, even if they've hugely raised defense spending, and nobody on our side has pointed out the contradiction in terms there. That's utterly ridiculous. You can't call yourself a small spender if you spend it huge on defense, because guess what? Defense counts too. It's actually part of the government, remember? But we've let them we've let them define government spending as only spending on helping people as opposed to blowing crap up. So
this is where we are.
That's where we've gotten. And that's, and I guess to circle around to where I began, that to me is the bigger danger of this. I don't think the Republicans will take it. So I'm actually not worried about this, about Simpson-Bowles passing. But what I'm more worried about is if this is the de facto position of the Democratic Party, that cutting Social Security and Medicare is good, this is who we are, we're centristy and such, then where do they move to the next election cycle? Where do we move to from there? Where do we go from Social Security? We're willing to cut Social Security in return for tax cuts too. It's a good thing to cut Social Security, and we should do it.
Right.
When do we get there?
Right. I mean, you know? the marker is being set when the it is the case that the Obama administration has the rate of spending, the annualized growth of federal spending under Reagan's first term was 8.7%. That was the high water mark. Under Bush, and people should remember that the stimulus passed under Bush. The 2009 budget was passed in 2008 before Obama was president. He had the second highest, Bush too, second highest annualized spending at 8.1%. Obama from 2010 to 2013 has been 1.4%. And they are bragging about this.
We let these guys get religion on deficits every single time they create huge deficits and we take over.
And the problem is, though, the problem is that the next time we're in this financial crisis or even in this crisis, how do you then argue, we've got to start spending? Well, wait a second. You guys were saying 2 years ago you were bragging about how you weren't spending. Why would
We've already gotten there. Right. I mean, we've already gotten there, Sam. That was the whole issue when some of us, and I think you and I were among them, and talking again on this wonderful program of yours, banging our heads on our desks when Obama was using that idiotic analogy to families tightening their belts. Right. When you make that argument, then you've just given up. Because at that point, you're explaining to people a very difficult thing, which is how the economy works, which is not something that makes sense. I had to take a number of classes till it made sense to me. You know, it's not something that I think you just basically understand without people explaining it to you and educating you on it. And when you give that simple an answer to the whole thing, and say that if we just tighten our belts, then things will get better, and that's what families should do too, then you're teaching them fundamentally the wrong thing. And what you're doing is boxing yourself in. So in the future, when you need to raise spending, they'll say, but I don't understand. You're supposed to tighten your belt the way family does. Mm. And that's where you end up. And I know we need to go soon, but I need to read you one quick thing. Are we about to go,
yes,
Sam?
Yes, read me the thing.
Can I read you this? Because this is important. I got this sent to me. I wrote a column 2 weeks ago on my syndicated column, which thankfully is picked up by a bunch of papers out among the different states and cities, and I got this sent back to me, and this is the stuff that gets me upset. The hate mail, which I'm sure you get and I get, I actually kind of laugh at and enjoy. I mean, obviously, if it's of a threatening nature, I'm a little more concerned, but this is the stuff that gets me upset. So there's a woman named Brandy, and I'm not going to give any more information except for to read this. I hope my Social Security and Medicaid don't get cut because I'm not able to work. I won't have a home to live in or no medical and psychiatric care. I get very suicidal sometimes, excuse me, and I need my meds to care and keep me alive. It would be a disaster for others like me and people worse than me. I think Congress should stop dipping in our vital programs. There might be a war in America when it happens. It's all we can do to survive. Take Social Security from rich people and take it from those that don't need it and those that defraud Social Security and fake being disabled. Sorry about my frustrations. Thanks, Brandy. I mean, here's somebody, you know, writing me a letter, obviously read my column. I'm not sure in which newspaper, but, believe it or not, lefty me, my column gets picked up in some places like Montana and Arkansas and some other newspapers. And here's this woman who essentially is saying to me that this is all she's able to live on. She's going to be homeless without it. She's going to lose her medical care and psychiatric care, and that she's suicidal. And these are the people you need to remember when we're talking about these grand bargains and people are cutting ribbons and smiling and putting their arms around each other and putting a bipartisanship fetish, you know, at the front of the table and saying it's more important than we agree that we do the right policy. These are the people that will suffer from this.
Indeed. Well, well said, Cliff. Have a great weekend.
Sorry, I don't mean on our Friday show to end up on that note.
It's very frustrating for me. And I think that's well said. And that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point.
Well, thanks for having me on, as always. And the love is still there. And I'll try to laugh more next week.
Thanks, Cliff. All right, we're going to take...
Thanks, Sammy. I appreciate it.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. I'm going to take a quick break, folks. When we come back, we're going to lighten the mood a little bit. Dave Hill will be joining us to talk about his new book, Tasteful Nudes, in just one brief moment. We'll be right back after this.
Drill, baby, drill, not stall, baby, stall.
That woman is an idiot.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that part. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him,
we didn't want a garden variety politician.
Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of the now released, I hold here in my hand, Tasteful Nudes and Other Misguided Attempts at Personal Growth and Validation. Of course, I am talking about the one, the only Dave Hill, comedian and musician. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Dave, you're here, of course, today to tell me what movie I should view on Netflix streaming or Amazon streaming, as I do over the weekend, because I'm not allowed to go to the movies anymore because I'm married and have a child, and that's the rules.
Yes. Okay.
What do you mean? Why are you...
Do you want my choices?
What?
No. Wait, why am I what? No, it's just taking it all in. You're not allowed to. I understand.
Okay, where are you now, Matt, Dave? Where are we talking? Where are you?
I'm in a bunker. I'm under duress right now. No, I'm in Soho, in Manhattan.
Yeah.
I got a job.
What job? You got a job? What do you mean you got a job?
I know. No one's more upset about it than I am. I got a job writing on a TV show.
Wait, what TV show?
It's an untitled program for the popular MTV network. It's being done by the comedy duo Evan and Gareth from Los Angeles.
I have no idea what that is.
Show business person Jim Biederman is the executive producer. You know Jim.
I do know Jim. I've worked with Jim many times in the past. I tell him I appreciate the phone call.
Yeah, yeah. No, he was just talking about it. He was doing an impression for me.
He was doing an impression of me?
No, he was doing a Rupert Murdoch impression.
What do you mean he was doing a Rupert? He was doing a Rupert Murdoch impression for you.
He just drops in and out of it sometimes. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, I understand. Dave, tell me about this book. I mean, I'm going to pretend like I haven't read. I've read parts of it. I got to be honest with you. I leave it in the bathroom, and that's where I read it.
Oh, thank you. It's good for that. I mean, I've broken it up to make it work like that. It's very short essays. It's probably good. If you were battling a gastrointestinal situation,
yeah,
it's probably that's the length. It's right for that. So it's not for like in an. I guess you would know better than I would because I haven't read it in the bathroom myself. You find it works well for your...
It's great, and I think it was brilliant for you to use that that antibiotic cover. So that it doesn't pass on germs. That's a brilliant idea.
And it wipes down very easily.
Are you talking on a speakerphone?
No, you know, I'm in this weird office, and I'm in the most padded room. Let me move to another room. Is it really echoey?
Yeah, it's strange. They have no furniture where you're working?
Let me see if this is any better. Is this any better?
Slightly.
No, it's this place. You know how these offices are. It's all like raw space and people interacting with each other.
Yeah.
And it's just very echoey. And I asked them to put me in the least echoey room in the entire place. And it's still a remarkably echoey room.
Talk towards the
carpet. It's a nightmare. Yeah, yeah. Maybe I'll get down on the ground.
I saw a video that you made to promote this with Dick Cavett and Malcolm Gladwell, and they both seemed like they were both uncomfortable being there.
Yeah, they had an awful time. They were trapped. It was in the back of the tavern chain.
Now it sounds like you actually have gone into a bunker because now your phone's breaking up.
Oh, Jesus. How's it?
Go back into the original place and just talk into the carpet.
Let's go back to one. I'm sorry.
You're doing this on purpose.
No, not at all. I've been looking forward to this call for months and months. Now I'm on the floor. Is this better?
Yeah, that sounds better. You know, Janine Garofalo on the back of your book. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Dave.
Yes.
First of all, Dave Hill is a pathological liar. A fantasist, an egotist, and an unlicensed podiatrist. I cannot confirm the veracity of anything this book, but my feet have never felt better. And as Dave always says, when you have your feet, you have everything. Dave, tell us about this story of you going to you wearing the Santa Claus thing, going to a party because I think it's a great story for me to talk about myself.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I got, I was invited to a Christmas party. I was living in Cleveland at the time. I'm from Cleveland.
I didn't know that your family was Canadian either. You're like 1/8 Canadian, aren't you? I saw you
I'm a quarter Canadian.
You played hockey as a kid, which is, if anybody knows you, you seem to be like the last person who would ever play hockey.
I know. Well, any sport whatsoever. My skill at hockey was more of an autism because I can't play any other sport. It's just this weird ability that I have. It's like the one sport I can play for some reason. But yeah, I played up until my sophomore year in college, and I came out of retirement in my 20s. Played in an old men's league. Beat up an old man. Got kicked out.
Nice.
And,
you got into a fight with an old man in a hockey league, and you got kicked out of a hockey league?
I beat up. My mom got me into this hockey league because my mom, you know, she's half Canadian. So she she would go ice skating all the time, you know, where the organ music is playing and everything. And so she met this guy who ran a hockey league, and she's like, yeah, he said you could join the league. So I joined the league, and then I was playing in it, and I beat up this guy who's, you know, 25 years older than me. He was just playing dirty, so I thought I had to hand out my own swift brand of justice, and I beat him up, and I got kicked out. And this is
How old were you, Dave?
I was probably like 28, maybe.
What's your mom doing signing you up for a hockey league when you're 28 years old?
She's half Canadian. Like, it was a point of pride. She wanted to bring me out of retirement.
Okay.
You know, because I hadn't played since my sophomore year in college. But she brought me out of retirement. My triumphant return to the ice. I beat the crap out of probably a 50-year-old man, I guess. And I got kicked out. Suspended, but effectively kicked out.
Yeah.
For the rest of the season. Because the suspension went longer than the season.
And then you went to a Christmas party.
Oh, yeah. Then the Christmas party comes in. But anyway, backing up, my mom found out I got kicked out of the league. And she was entertained by it, though, as a half-Canadian woman. She thought it was very funny that I beat the crap out of someone. Because I've never been in a fight in my entire life off the ice. And when it comes to hockey, I fight all the time. But, yeah, Santa Claus, I got invited to a Christmas party in Cleveland, like a charity event for this public theater and so I said, yeah, I'll come to the Christmas party if I have to be Santa Claus. And they said, well, we already have a Santa Claus. And I said, I don't think you heard me. I'll come to your Christmas party if I can be Santa Claus. I just held out, and then they're like, all right, you know, we actually got a new Santa Claus suit for this guy, so we have the old one. And this was like, you know, like World War II era Santa Claus suit, just stained, smelling of various fluids.
What kind of bodily fluid is going to be on a Santa Claus outfit, honestly?
I mean, a fair amount of urine, but not just, I mean, bodily fluid, sweat, urine, and then, you know, but then probably whiskey and, you know, cigarette stains, and it was foul. But, you know, I pulled it on. It still felt magical. And it's the best. Sam, have you ever been Santa Claus?
No, I've been the Easter Bunny.
Oh, so you know.
Oh, yeah.
When you walk into the room as a fictional character on a holiday, everyone lights up. It's just, everyone's so excited to see you.
No, I worked as an Easter Bunny in a mall, and the kids were terrified of me. Because I was 12 feet tall. Yeah, and the parents would insist on putting them on my lap for a photograph, and the kids are going, no, no. It's a huge rabbit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did you have like a mascot head on? Or were you just
wearing... No, it was massive. Yeah, oh, yeah. No, it was a full-on, like, Disney-style uniform.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. And people weren't excited?
No, the kids were terrified.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you gotta be Santa Claus sometimes to feel this.
All right. Well, tell me the story, because we only got a couple minutes here.
Oh, I thought we were doing a solid hour.
No.
Okay, I'll tell you.
Sorry.
Power of suggestion. Yeah. So I go to the thing, and you know, well, first I test the Santa suit up. I go to a few other parties and dress as Santa Claus. When you walk in, everyone's so excited when Santa Claus shows up. It's like it would be like Elvis showing up in Vegas or something. It's like
right,
the perfect person. It's the greatest thing. Or Barbra Streisand walking in anywhere. That's what it's like. People are just so, everyone's happy. But it wears off in about 5 minutes, and then you're just this creepy guy who showed up by himself and is wearing this old, nasty Santa suit. No one will look you in the eye. And then so you have to leave and try to get your, you know, get that high again, get your fix. You go to the next party, and, you know, the high is a little shorter every time. It's not quite the same. You got to keep going. So I finally go to this charity event. Another thing with being Santa Claus, everyone's excited to see you, at least for a little while.
Yeah.
And everyone loves buying Santa Claus drinks. It's the best scenario for that. So I was just getting hammered on all these free Santa Claus drinks. And
And this guy says something lewd to my girlfriend, and she tells me what he says, and it's not appropriate for radio, but it's just awful. And she's like, don't say anything, you know, don't do anything. But so I'm like, all right, I won't. And then, you know, an hour goes by, and I have more of these free Santa Claus drinks. And then I was like, I better set this guy straight. And I go up to him, and I confront him about, you know, saying these things to my girlfriend. And as I said, I've never been in a fight off the ice in my entire life. And I'm pretty sure we're like getting in each other's faces, and he's denying having said anything. And I'm like, I think I'm going to get in a fight. I'm going to beat the crap out of this guy. Like, this is going to happen. Like, you know, and I start clenching my fist, and I'm thinking like, I'm going to pummel this guy. And I catch my reflection in the window, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I'm Santa Claus. Like, I can't beat the crap out of this guy. Like, you can't.
You can't hit somebody as Santa Claus.
You can't beat anyone up when you're dressed as Santa Claus, and you can't lose dressed as Santa Claus. I mean, that's even worse, to get your ass kicked and you're dressed as Santa Claus. It's just like a double, you know. So I decided to quit.
Dave,
and I think
Dave,
he was relieved.
Dave.
Yeah.
We're having problems with your phone. We got to go. We're going to have to do this again next week. You're going to have to come back and give me a movie review.
Okay. Well, I have one. Do you want me to tell you, or I'll bring it in next week?
Next week. Tasteful nudes, folks, and other misguided attempts at personal growth and validation. We got a link up at majority.fm. Dave, we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, thanks, Sam.
All right. All right, folks, got to go into the better half of the show. If you're listening live, we're going to end it today because I got to run. But on the podcast, we'll have more for you if you're a member, and you can become a member at majority.fm. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you then.